Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian novelist Tor Roxburgh, who's recently released her fantasy novel, The Light Heart of Stone. Welcome to the podcast, Tor.
Thank you, Sean. Good morning.
Yes, it is a good morning here. No rain and no wind. Hopefully Victoria's got it all.
Yes, it has, let me assure you.
All right. I'll launch straight into it. You've written for about the past 20 years, and you've a number of fiction and non-fiction titles to your name. What inspired you to write Light Heart of Stone and branch out into fantasy?
Well, I'd in fact been a fantasy and science fiction reader since I was a teenager. Loved the genre. And I guess I'm one of those writers who didn't take the very good and standard advice to write what you read. So in the beginning of my fiction writing career, because I write both fiction and non-fiction, I had the opportunity to write some, well, to pitch to write some teen romance. And I'm not a romance reader, so in some sense I probably should have said no, but I absolutely loved writing. I'd been writing non-fiction. And I thought, well, you know, I'll give it a crack. And put in a couple of story proposals, and they got accepted and commissioned, and that launched me into this career of writing teen romance, which I did for a number of years. And so, in a sense, I never got to writing fantasy and science fiction, even though that's what I wanted to do in the beginning. And so I come to it quite sort of well into my career, and with great pleasure too. It feels like coming home.
Well, as you've indicated there, you've been traditionally published, but with this book decided to self-publish in both e-book and paperback form. Mm. What led you to make that decision?
Well, I don't know that many people would choose to do it in a positive way. Often there is something that goes wrong in the process towards getting published in the mainstream, and that was the case with me. So I have an agent, and my agent doesn't represent fantasy or science fiction. So that was my first barrier. She didn't have anything against the manuscript itself. She just wasn't interested whatsoever. And then I started sending it around to various publishers. So I sent it to Penguin, and they liked it, but not quite enough. And they said, you know, please show us your next work. So I thought, oh, well, that's nearly there. I'll keep trying. I sent it to Harper Voyager and Hachette Australia, and they both said no. You know, you don't know at the receiving end whether your manuscript's been read. Perhaps I did a bad job with the synopsis. I don't know. The upshot was, anyway, they didn't want it. And there were some more publishers I could try, but I just had this feeling that at this point in my life, I didn't want to spend the next 2 years sending it around, waiting. It's such an awful passive sort of situation to be in. And, you know, I was somewhat emboldened by having been a professional writer for, you know, more than 20 years, and I believed in the story, and I had a lot of friends and family readers who were really liking it, although, of course, we all know that you can't really rely on that. But I thought, well, look, I'll take a chance, and it has been the most incredibly rewarding experience. It's amazing. It's quite different from being published by a mainstream publisher.
Okay, yeah, no, I was going to say that I really found it, yeah, quite a fresh and fascinating book. And having received fantasy books from all those publishers you've mentioned, I mean, it easily sits alongside any other book that they've published in the fantasy genre. So, yeah, I think it's a shame they didn't pick it up. But, I mean, they've got business decisions to make, and you never know what happens.
Exactly.
But,
exactly.
Yeah, no, I think in the review I wrote, I thought, you know, why didn't some major publisher pick it up? But you've sort of outlined the reasons there, maybe.
Yeah. Look, I really was thinking about it yesterday, because I thought you might ask me about this, and I thought, you know, it could well be that I don't write a good synopsis. It may never have got past that point. You don't know when you're waiting, you know, in your little garret whether your manuscript's actually been read. But I think that I'm going to be a better writer for having gone through this process, because you have to work so hard when you publish your own book, and you really have to step up and own it in a way that you don't have to do when you've got the endorsement of a mainstream publisher. I think it's been good for me.
Okay, that sort of leads into my next question. Some listeners, certainly not all, might think that self-publishing might be a cheaper or quicker option. Now, from my memory, when you spoke at Continuum 8, you related that you'd place substantial financial investment in Lighthearted of Stone. Yeah. Could you perhaps just outline, you know, the process you had to go through to satisfy your own sort of level of professionalism?
Yeah, sure. As well as having written 14 books before I self-published The Lighthearted of Stone, I've also worked in publishing. So I worked at Reed Books, which is imprints like William Heinemann and Minerva, and I worked in the contracts and rights department there. And I've worked at RMIT Publishing as a managing editor. And I've also run a public art business, which involves tendering for work, getting contracts, you know, designing an item and then seeing it fabricated and installed. So I have quite a good understanding of the manufacturing aspect of books and quite a good understanding of how to get things up to a professional level. And because I am a professional writer and I came somewhat reluctantly to self-publishing, I wanted to do the best job I possibly could. I wanted to honour the tradition of publishing and also do the right thing by my writing as well. So I didn't go the route at all of any of the self-publishing companies who can assist you. And, you know, I believe they do a very good job. What I did was I acted as a genuine publisher would. So I got an editor. And I had a author-editor relationship with my editor. Then I put on my little marketing hat and I went to visit a whole lot of different bookshops, and I talked to booksellers about book covers, and we discussed what fiction book covers are looking like at the moment, what fantasy and science fiction book covers look like at the moment, what the booksellers thought was likely to... Well, what was in fashion at the moment and what was likely to date quickly, and what direction I could look at. Then I wrote up a formal brief for the cover designer. Then I decided that I wanted the interior designed, and I got a recommendation from Zoe Dantner at Spunk, which is the independent publishing organisation, although I couldn't become a member of that because they won't accept self-publishers, only independent publishers, which is a bit sad. So she gave me a recommendation of someone who could design the interior for me, and I commissioned that work. And then that designer put me onto a typesetter that Graham Jones from Kirby Jones, who works regularly for HarperCollins, and he did, a really beautiful job on the interior. And then he recommended a printer based in Hong Kong. I also looked into getting the book printed in Australia, so I got quite a few quotes around and about. But the book is not huge by epic fantasy standards, but it's a big, solid book of 640 pages. And it really, being my own publisher, brought home to me why publishers are a bit reluctant to publish very long manuscripts. It's very hard to keep the unit cost down, and having been a small business person, I didn't want it to be a vanity enterprise. I wanted it to be a genuine commercial enterprise, so I wanted to ensure that I could conceivably make money out of the book, and so I ended up going with the Hong Kong publisher, and they gave me the best price. So then it was a matter of putting in the order, working with the sales rep, getting the book shipped over, going through customs. You know, it was really interesting. And then that's not even the marketing and publicity. That's just the getting the book made.
I must say that I had the ebook copy to review, and the device I use is a Kobo, and sometimes, you know, doesn't seem to be any particular publisher, but sometimes the formatting is thrown out, what have you. And I found Light Heart of Stone to be extremely well done in that it seemed to be the format. There was no formatting issues. It was really smooth, and I was just wondering, did you go to a specialist service for that?
Yeah. I did. I looked around. I had a few people recommended to me, and I ended up going with Greenslade Creations, Amanda Greenslade in Queensland. I just liked her. She was really nice. She, you know, it's a funny thing, isn't it? But she had a lovely voice, and she was fun to talk to. And she was so ready to address any problems I found. I thought, why bother to get the print book done well if I'm not going to try and get the e-book done well? So I'm glad that it was good at your end. Very pleased, yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than, you know, every 5 or 6 lines that, you know, you get a hard return where a hard return shouldn't be.
Yes.
It's amazing how that can throw off your reading experience.
Yes, yes. I remember one of the first e-books I read, it didn't distinguish the paragraphs well, and it didn't show the gaps when a scene had finished, those extra gaps that you get in a book, in a hard copy book. And the book didn't make sense because the layout wasn't there. It just was very, very disturbing.
Yeah, it's amazing how much a space can convey a scene change.
Yeah.
And how you can, you've just read a paragraph and you've gone, hang on, we're not talking, the same people aren't talking, or we're not in the same place we just were.
Yeah, what happened?
We'll talk a bit more about the book. As I said, I thought Light Heart of Stone was fresh and exciting. There's enough sort of familiar touchstones for the standard fantasy reader.
Mm.
But there are some additional interesting touches. I'm going to ask you to give a pitch here. For the standard fantasy reader, how would you pitch your book?
Well, I would say that this is an epic fantasy based on Australian themes. And the essence of the story is that it's an alternate world where plants and animals need human companions in order to thrive. And it's set on a continent where there are Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And the Indigenous and non-Indigenous people have been in a contractual treaty relationship for 700 years. When the book opens, everything looks as though it's going to be in harmony, but it isn't, in spite of the fact that the Indigenous people own all of the land, and the colonising people bring to the party the ability to companion plants and animals, things are starting to fall apart. There have been agricultural failures. And so the task of the main characters is to save the world, as it should be in epic fantasy. And there are plenty of familiar devices in there. So we have a forced adoption, a talented child taken from her family, which fantasy readers presumably will be very familiar with, and I always enjoy those stories, so I got to put in all the bits and pieces that I enjoy in fantasy, and that's, I guess, part of the fun of writing it.
You've sort of touched on several of the next questions, so I'll try and reframe them so that I don't. But I obviously picked up on strong themes around colonisation, ecological failure, refugees, removal of children, and the denial of culture. You've hinted at there where you drew that from, in an Australian context. What did you feel that you had to tap into that Australian inspiration, I suppose? Did you feel that that was something that was missing in...
I did.
..in fantasy?
You know, I think that we... You know, we can write about strange worlds and worlds that are unrelated to our own, and we can write about sort of ancient traditions to which we're still connected. But, you know, I'm a white Australian and from Scottish background, and, you know, we've been here for 200 years. But we're not writing about here. We're not putting our themes into fantasy and science fiction necessarily, which I think is a great pity. And I guess because I'm also a non-fiction writer and my non-fiction is about fairly serious things like family violence and youth homelessness, you know, as opposed to my silly teen romance. And I felt very affected by the reports on the Stolen Generations and very affected by, you know, Aboriginal issues. But I didn't want to write about them as non-fiction because I'm not an Aboriginal person and I didn't feel that I really had the standing or the right to write about it in that way. But I did feel like we're living in this shared continent and I felt that it was quite okay for me to write thematically about those things in fiction because, you know, I have those feelings that we're still building our culture on a fragile base that we haven't properly reconciled with our history. And I want, you know, that all sounds really worthy and serious, but obviously the book is an adventure story and it isn't a heavy read, I don't think.
No, I certainly, I mentioned in my review, I didn't feel as though I was reading a polemic or a non-fiction book in fiction's guise sort of thing. I thought,
good.
You know, yeah. I could sense the themes and I thought, well, that might be interesting from my perspective as a teacher to have probably, you know, your senior students look at that and go, you know, what parallels can you draw out? Because to me it might seem a bit more obvious because of my history reading background, but to a kid, yeah, it might just be that distance from real history that they can look at it with fresh eyes. Yeah. I thought that was handled really well.
Oh, thank you. I'm really pleased about that. I did set out to explore ideas rather than give a message, so I'm glad that came through as a genuinely open-minded exploration.
Okay, I'm going to pick on two of the what I termed interesting touches in the book. The first of these was the indigenous method of storytelling and knowledge gathering called the Four Stories. And I read this and I thought, gee, this has a real anthropological verisimilitude. Can you tell us where did you think about it yourself? Is it inspired?
No, I'm really happy to tell you about that. That was something that I enjoyed working on. It actually came from both my political thoughts and also personal thoughts. So I live in a family like everybody's family where there are rifts where people cannot agree on past events, you know, in spite of the fact that, you know, it may be siblings or it might be a parent-child relationship, even though those people have lived through a shared event, they come out with really different accounts of what happened. And we see that obviously at a national level, you know, again, thinking about Indigenous, non-Indigenous relations, really different accounts. I mean, you can think about Australia being discovered or you can think about it being invaded. Their shared experiences in our community memory, but we don't have a single story. And the same is true internationally. You know, you think of the horrendous conflicts that are there because people can't agree on a single story. And one of the things that I've always liked in life is not just tolerance for difference, but embracing difference, really enjoying difference. And I was thinking about creating the world of the Indigenous people in my novel, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice? Because clearly, I'd already worked out that there was a setup where there was an issue about truths in history, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice if the culture had some way of dealing with divergent historical accounts of events? And then there was another factor that entered into that. So I had this idea of two diverging stories of the same event. And then another factor fed into that, and that was probably studying feminist philosophy at university and coming across that notion that there is no neutral narrator, that a narrator always has a gender always has an emotional state that they're in, and that, you know, a pretense of an unbiased narrator is in some ways not a healthy thing in a culture. So I thought, okay, so I've got two stories of the most divergent accounts of something that happened, and then I've got this idea of having a narrator that owns up to their state, you know, who they are and what they're doing telling that story. So there's three stories. And I, like many people, have a love of fairy tales and folk tales. And also a very good friend who's a psychoanalyst, Karen Hawkes, who over the years of our friendship has talked to me about interpreting, you know, our lives in terms of tales and stories. And I thought, okay, so there's a fourth story and there's a cycle. So you begin by the narrator telling their own story, then you have one account of something that happened, then you have the most divergent account of what happened, and then you top that off with a folk tale or a fairy tale, and you do a little bit of interpretive discussion. And I thought, gee, that I quite like that. So I put that in.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking, you know, you look at some fantasy books, and I'm thinking of Brandon Sanderson, will design his magic system in the book. It was almost as if it was being prepared for a computer game or a role-playing game. It's almost the science of magic.
Okay.
And I thought, gee, that's almost doing the same sort of thing, but with stories. And I thought it was marvellous. I thought, gee, is there a culture around here that I haven't heard of that does that?
There might be. I'm not sure. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there was. You know, often when you think you're making something up, you're not. You know, it's already there. Yeah.
It felt real to me is what I suppose I came away with. And I just thought, as you've just explained it then, I just thought, yeah, well, that really does sort of work. That's a really interesting way of bringing stories together in a sort of non-technological society. I thought it was very, very well done. Probably my favourite part of the book, aside from the main story itself.
Thank you.
Also, having a look at the Companionari culture, which are the colonising or invading force, I thought it was really, really good. And obviously, from your background, you can tell why. But it wasn't just like a insert Western colonial power here. Mm. They were quite different. It's a matriarchal society.
Yeah.
With a political system that seems designed to make the wheels of bureaucracy turn even slower than they might do in Canberra. So I wondered, what was the inspiration for their culture? If you could give us the same sort of treatment that you've just given us for the four stories.
Yeah. Look, it comes from diverse places again. And, you know, some of it is from recent things in my life. So I moved to live in regional Victoria full-time about 3 years ago, but part-time about 9 years ago. And I kept meeting lots of older women who were into gardening, companion planting, and talking about slow culture. And they were fascinating women, but I've always got, you know, as many writers do, that slightly step back and observe and think a different thought. And I did start to wonder whether, I don't know whether people are talking about slow culture over in Adelaide, but whether slow culture could have a dark side, whether it could rest on poorer people working even harder and having even less time. And I thought, for my colonising culture, maybe I'd like to have a culture that was intensively slow, had technology but didn't use it, because a sign of wealth would be to do things slowly and laboriously, and for them not to see that they were exploiting the other people, the Indigenous people. And as far as their political structure goes, so I have them without a centralised government. I have it's kind of a direct democracy in a way, that any of the Companionaris can come together and make decisions, but their decisions might be in some ways binding, but can be overridden by another group of companionaries coming together in a parley and making another decision that contradicts the first one. And I guess in my early adulthood, I worked in a feminist collective which had consensus decision-making, and I found it very interesting. And in general, I am very interested in other ways of thinking about political decision-making and running societies. And, you know, the feminist collective had its strengths and its weaknesses, and here was another sort of system that clearly had strengths and weaknesses. So I that's a bit of a rambling account of that. I hope that makes some sense.
Oh, I think so. Now that you've explained it, I can sort of, you know, my understanding of feminist collectives and the slow culture you're talking about, I can see where that's coming from. So I think I might have to go back and read the book again. I think there'd be quite a few of our listeners that might just be turned into reading based on what you've explained there, because I in my review, I didn't really focus on any sort of feminist aspects. I'm not having a strong feminist theory background. Mm. But, hopefully some of the listeners out there would will take the chance to have a look at it, because I think that's just given added depth to my reading of it, just listening to you speak about it there.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks. Well, I hope they do, and I'm... one of the experiences about self-publishing is that I've had a much more intimate relationship with readers, because every reader has been really matters to me in a way that doesn't happen, I don't think, when you're published in a traditional way. And I've had some wonderful experiences of people getting in touch with me and having discussions about what they've read, and I've really enjoyed that. It never happened to me before in all the other books I've written, so it's fantastic. And I'd love it for more people to read the book. It'd be great.
Well, on that point, I think it's one of the better books I've read this year.
Thank you.
That's all right. I had the pleasure of reading it. I'd describe it as a bit of a diamond in the rough of self-publishing, that sort of huge wave of lots of books coming out. And I've got no qualms in pointing listeners in its direction. Can you perhaps tell us where we can get ebook copies and wonderful paperback copy?
Now, it is available in bookshops, but you'd have to probably order it. I've got a distributor, Dennis Jones and Associates, and they can get it out to any bookshop in Australia. So if people do want a paperback and they like going down to their local bookshop, don't hesitate to go in and ask your bookshop salesperson to order it. It's also available in Australia from my website, which is lightoutofstone.com. And you can buy it through PayPal on the website, and I'll post it out. Equally, you can get a print-on-demand version from Amazon if you like doing that sort of thing. And if you want the ebook, it's available Amazon, iTunes, and any day now, Kobo, and also from my website. So it's everywhere. You just have to overcome that business that the bookshop probably hasn't heard of it being self-published. It doesn't have as high a profile.
It also possible perhaps for libraries to order it through Dennis
Jones? Definitely, definitely.
Okay.
Well, actually through James Bennett. James Bennett is the library supplier. So, yes, I've had quite a good take-up from libraries, actually. I've been really pleased. So probably about a third of my physical book sales have been to libraries. So, you know, that's really pleasing.
Okay. Well, I'll add those into the show notes, the links to your website, and leave readers to find the paperback copies themselves.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Tor, and good luck with the sales of the book. And, hang on, before I go, I've heard a whisper about book two, tentatively titled Promise of Stone. When would we...
It's all plotted out, and I'm planning to start writing it in March. And I think definitely it's going to be a lot faster than the first book. I think, you know, once you've made the commitment that the first book is done, then, you know, the whole world is created and it's more a question of story writing then within the world. So in the meantime, I'm writing a young adult science fiction murder mystery crossover. So I just want to get a draft of that out of the way, and then early next year I'll be starting volume two.
Oh, excellent. Excellent news. Well, thank you again for coming on the podcast, and good luck with the book.
Thanks, Sean, and thanks for having me. It was really exciting.